What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine.
Thank you for being here. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. And yet again, I have another really good guest. Blair Richwood is with me this week, and Blair has been in film, TV, theater, and literary development for 29 years, and at one time, she was the head of development for Gary Marshall's company. Well, she also is an excellent book editor and edited my book, The Me Generation by Me, Growing Up in the 60s, available at Amazon, and really improved the book greatly. Blair is here, and we are going to talk about feature development, what producers and studios are looking for, what they're not looking for, some tips for writers, things not to do. This is a very informative episode if you happen to be a screenwriter. Also, some advice on pitching pilots and screenplays, what Netflix and some of the streaming services are looking for these days, and what does an editor do? What is the value of a good editor? We'll also be talking about adaptations, lots and lots of good stuff. Blair Richwood, which is not an easy name to say, by the way. Blair Richwood is with me, and here's my chat with her.
Hollywood and Levine.
Okay, first I want to talk a little bit about Gary Marshall, because you worked with Gary Marshall, and he was an inspiration and a mentor to me, and he was such a positive force in my life. For me, it was a real blessing to be associated with Gary Marshall, and I assume the same is true for you.
Absolutely. Talk about force in your life and inspiration. He was my first job in the business. And I believe in nepotism, because Gary was really just doing a favor for his college roommate, Tom Kuhn, who was head of NBC programming at the time. And my mom was his assistant. And Gary tells Tommy, I've got to get a new assistant. Tom tells Mom, your daughter's ready for a job. I go in for my meeting with him, all dressed in my 80s suit and shoulder pads. And he says, well, I'm just meeting you as a favor because I'm not going to hire a girl. Well, I'm glad you know that. And I noticed that there was a light out in the fixture above his desk. So while I was speaking about all I was planning to do in the theater world and how I could help, I dragged a chair over from this corner. I stood on it. I got up. I unscrewed the light bulb. And I stepped back down and said, where do you keep your spares? And he said, you're hired. So I proved handy. So he inspired a lot of people because he made people fall in love with making his movies. And that's why he got people to do them over and over again.
He was such a positive force.
Yes, and he taught me that you want to nurture a film into existence. And I had another boss, a wonderful woman named Laura Ziskin, who taught me you needed to force a movie into existence. not the case, not the kind you really love doing over and over again.
So when you're working for Gary, you found yourself in a position of head of development for his company, which meant, I'm sure, that you read thousands of screenplays. What were you looking for in a screenplay? And I ask this because probably one out of every three listeners to this podcast is working on a spec screenplay.
I hope they are. To find the right movie, it would have to have heart. It would have to have humor. The script had to be to tell a clear story that I could tell to Gary from the moment we walked out of the office to putting him in his car. That's the length of a pitch.
Okay.
So the main thing I could tell your listeners is have a story that is so crystal clear that the assistant or the DFD or the VP can tell it to their boss as they walk them to the car.
Yeah, that's one thing that we learned in television, because when you go in and when you pitch pilots, you are pitching to somebody who can't make the final decision.
Absolutely.
So that person then goes and talks to the decision maker. And if your pilot is not something really crystal clear that they can't just tell him in three, four sentences, you're dead, because he's going, wait, what is it? He's a guy, and he's an immigrant, and he comes to the thing, and there's that, and he's got parents, and like, what? I don't know what you're talking about here. So, yeah. Let's talk about story elements. What makes for a good story?
These days?
These days, yeah. Now the Greek days.
Yeah, the Greek days. Or we're not still in the Gary days. They must fit the context for who you're pitching, for who you're target audience is. So the elements for a good story, if you're taking it into Netflix and it plans to be a limited series, I'm working on some of those right now, those elements, they have to have a lot of subplots, a lot of relationships, a lot of potential for living out its life. An element for a good screenplay has to have the genre, the plot, and the story.
And a superhero.
These days. Uh-huh. And somebody that we are fascinated by. Your writers might be starting with character, and I would just say make sure they've got enough flaws that they are challenged to overcome them and decide if they're the person who changes in the story or if they stay the same and changes everyone else.
Now, you bring up an interesting point about a character who is fascinating, because you also hear people say, well, you got to have a character that the audience roots for. And I've always maintained, not necessarily.
Agreed with you.
You know, that you need a character who is fascinating and complex, and you're just interested watching him. I mean, you know, going back to the old TV days of the 80s and Dallas and J.R. Ewing, you know? I mean, this guy was just a horrible human being. And yet, he was fascinating, and you watched each week. It doesn't have to be some heroic character.
Not at all. Especially with television, we need much more. I mean, I'm not talking broadcast because I haven't done that in a long time, although I certainly did the sitcoms with Gary. But in modern television, it's some of the most amazing writing, and it's long-form movies, and we need somebody who is complex enough, layered enough to want to follow week after week.
Now, HBO, I remember, used to say when we were pitching things to them that if it was a pitch that we could do for a network, they weren't interested.
Agreed.
Okay. And I assume it's the same thing with Netflix.
Very much with Netflix. The only people, although they are interestingly and smartly getting into the, I'm sure other people know this. This is, may not be insider trading, but they're getting into the family film holiday business. So they are going to do what a network might do if you consider Hallmark a network, which it okay. somewhat is.
Yeah.
But you're right. If you could pitch it to ABC, they can't use it. That's not their audience.
Right. Now, in terms of what Netflix is looking for, I mean, it's a whole different game plan. You know, it's not so much ratings. It has to do more with buzz and keeping subscribers. So you really can do a different kind of a show. It is not broadcasting per se.
You were talking about what a script needs to have.
Right.
Especially in modern television, aka cable, it needs to have a character that stars want to play, that actors want to play.
Right.
So before all that, you're going to have to craft amazing dialogue because they'll read down the middle. They won't always read all the narration and all the juicy stuff that you put in there. And I'm speaking about the first reader, which is the agent for the talent. So if you can package a piece, or if you can write a character that even not a star, but a magnificent actor wants to do, that is half your battle, truly. Or and if you're doing indies that you're going to direct yourself, same thing, but you also have to write a story then that a star-type director, a brilliant director, wants to get involved.
You know, I basically say the same thing. Somebody will give me a pilot, and I will say, well, who do you see playing her? And they'll say, Julia Roberts. And I'll say, do you think Julia Roberts would want to play this? You know?
Very smart advice, exactly.
Yeah, and it is so star-driven. I mean, at the end of the day, casting is everything.
Casting is everything, and know that your script will be casting a director, a DP, a costumer, a production designer. You're selling it to everyone. They all have to invest their time, their reputation, their career, their time away from their family. They're all investing in your script. And when we were talking about the pitch, one way your writers can manipulate the system is they've written what it is, 56 pages of an amazing pilot, but they're trusting that the reader will get that and then be able to assimilate that into a sentence to walk them, their boss, to their car and tell them, help them out with that. I put it sometimes on the title page. I might put the log line there. I will certainly have my clients put it in their email, submitting it. Tell the reader what they're supposed to read. This is a balls-out comedy about a frat boy and his lost twin sister, the nun.
I submit a lot of plays for festivals and things like that, and I always have a synopsis right
Absolutely.
On the title page.
Absolutely.
Yeah, just it tells them what it is.
And it positions it for them. It's not
right.
The kind of synopsis that a professional reader who's doing coverage for the agency would write. It's the positioning statement. So you'll have a sense of the world, a sense of the tone, a sense, you know, have the genre right there. Teach people how to read your material, and you're ahead of the game.
Now, a lot of times you can tell within the first five pages whether something is any good. What are some of the tells?
That it's good?
That it's bad.
Oh.
That it's bad. That it's like, oh, man, I can't get through 120 pages of this.
Well, first of all, if it's 120 pages, I send it back. I'll say, see me when you're at 110.
Okay.
Because then I'll get it down to 101 with 2 seconds. Some of the first things, if you don't have an important piece of dialogue on page one, I'll know you're leaving money on the table. You haven't thought it through. No reader wants to look at a first page that is full of ink.
Uh-huh.
We don't want a lot of description. If your descriptions are going over four lines, I know you have not gone over and edited yourself, polished yourself enough. If you have slug lines or set in a world where I'm unclear on the timing in just the first page or two, or if it seems like it's bigger than the story needs. If I know I'm reading a story about roommates and it's going to be a small indie drama and you open on the world of the new planet with the spaceships fighting, it better be a shot of a TV show you already have a clip of that they're dreaming about.
Yeah, and another thing too is you mentioned, you know, the budget.
Yeah.
Okay, because if somebody has a spec script and you see just on the first page, this is going to cost more than Avatar.
More than it's worth.
Yeah.
That's the trick.
Yeah. We once got a spec MASH script, and it opened with Hawkeye, kind of a dream sequence, where Hawkeye was on the mound at Yankee Stadium with 50,000 people. Like, how are you going to do that? You know, this was before CGI.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, how are you going to do that? So right away, you know, well, this person's clueless.
I don't want to see a dream sequence in my first several pages. I don't want to hear voiceover, right? You know, if you have to use it later. Unfortunately, voiceover is still sort of presumed from us old-time readers to be a fix for a movie.
Yeah, see, for me, And I've talked about this a lot in my blog. I think voiceovers and narration is lazy.
It is. It shows a weak writing. Absolutely.
Yeah. Instead of showing a character, the character is saying, oh, so I'm really depressed because I just flunked out of Michigan State, and so I'm trying to find a boyfriend. It's like, let's see that. Yeah.
Yeah. I've sent some clients into novel development when they have a script like that. Some writers have a story in them. They don't know where it belongs. Mm-hmm. So I remember one wonderful guy had a story in him that was just not a script in any way. Turns out he wanted to make a message, and we rewrote it as a sermon. And then he posted it on a sermon website that sells or basically leases sermons around the country.
Mm-hmm.
That's all he needed to do. So
God, I have a dream sermon. I wonder if anyone is interested. I have to talk to you about that afterwards.
Exactly. You have to think about, is the story right for the medium? If you are compelled to do a lot of voiceover, maybe you're writing an essay, a novel, a short story. But if you want to, so that's some ways where I can help people with figure out, gee, instead of saying I'm depressed, I dropped out of you, missed you, whatever, I have a new boyfriend, we could do that in one line of action as she's picking at her lip, throwing away her college papers.
Mm-hmm.
Done.
So I used you to edit my book, The Me Generation by Me.
That was so much fun, by the way.
I think it's really important for a writer, especially if you're writing something by yourself, just to have that perspective and have other people take a look at it. I remember handing you my manuscript and saying, is there a book in here somewhere? But it was really, really helpful. You did two things. Number one, you were very respectful in terms of giving your notes. And number two, you really held my feet to the fire. You really challenged me on certain things. And, there was a lot of times experienced writers will write something and know this section or this line, this is pretty flimsy, kind of putting a Band-Aid on it. Hopefully I can get away with it. You caught all of them.
I'm familiar with that because Gary also was a boy writer, mm-hmm, who was writing with partners, as you have, mm-hmm, been writing all, mm-hmm, your life, all your career.
He wrote with Jerry Belson, yeah.
And others. He didn't like a blank page. So he'd pitch out a story and other guys would pitch it back and they would type it up. With you, writing a book is a singular, lonely thing because you have a narrow circle of friends you trust who are good enough to give you notes and not just praise.
Right, right.
And that's what your mom's for, That's what your wife's for. Nice, honey. But you really do need a work spouse. You really do need somebody who can spot where you need to be better. And, I should insure my eyes with Lloyd's of London because I have fresh eyes. And you will never have fresh eyes,
right,
on your own,
right,
writing.
Right.
And my fresh eyes see the potential as clear as day. So a few things. If you think I did two things, that's great. I did 20. But if all I do with really ready material is strip away what isn't the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we have to polish, tap you to do better.
Right. Well, plus mine was a memoir, so the big question in my mind was always, does anybody give a crap about this?
Absolutely. What was so great about your piece, and I do do a lot of memoirs and edit them, developmental editing, you had your ideas, you had your book. You couldn't never unremember it. So I was helping you find the pieces that were especially universal. Everybody was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
Boom, you're ahead of the game right there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But it was very helpful because you really got me to open up more emotionally. And I think that's a problem that a lot of writers have, is we're really kind of afraid to expose ourselves emotionally.
You know, it's funny. I used this line with somebody recently, and they said, "Oh, you're a script doctor." And I said, "Well, I'm more of a script midwife. I really birth the emotion out of you." Because it's true, writers are reporting most of the time. Most people, you sort of reported your first, you know, the manuscript I saw. Mm-hmm. And I had to, a little bit, poke and tickle and prod and scrub to help you express how that feels. Because whether you're tuning into a TV or cable or watching on your damn little phone, or whether you're going
Titanic
to see
Titanic on your phone looks great, by the way. It's really great.
Or going especially to see a play. The reason we go with groups of people to be entertained is to be moved.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't go watch C-SPAN together.
Right.
Unless we need to throw things at. We go to be moved. And emotion moves people. Tap your emotion, you're ahead of the game.
Now, I was very happy to get your input. That's really what I sought. But you must also have writers who are resistant and very defensive. How do you deal with that?
I tell them I'm charging them by the hour. They can defend all they like. But what really happens is I'm able to more nurture the work away from having to defend it. They pay me in advance, so I've already got their money.
Right.
But it's more that they feel like they are assured by the notes they get, but more they see it in print with me, they are assured that I have the project's best interest in mind. It's not that I'm there to coddle them or to be their therapist. I see the potential in the project, and I'm helping them get to it. So the only defense I don't think I've had any sort of defending or pushback unless they had to explain what wasn't on the page. That's the most common. If I think that you're talking about a depressed woman in a small room and they thought they wrote about a girl going through her closet to pick out her wedding gown, it wasn't on the page. So they can be defensive against how it came across, but they are ultimately responsible. When they hear me read back the material to them, they understand how their words are being used. I work with many people when we revise together, I put them on my screen. We're on the phone. We're on a Zoom program. They're watching their script. We're both looking at their outline, their script, their manuscript together. And so we'll read the words together. Anybody reads aloud in their head still. That's why alliteration works. Alliteration doesn't work on the page. It works in our mental ear, right?
Right, right.
So when they hear things, they might defend, "No, that's the word I mean. I mean strumpet." And I'll have to tell them that most people won't know that word, unless we're doing it. But it might bring up other things. So they're really defending something that they just didn't know yet. There's resistance to getting better, however. That's different than being defensive against
Talk about that for a second.
Well, Stephen Pressman says it all that, Pressfield. I know a Pressman. This is Pressfield. Wrote The War of Art, all about the resistance. I have not read the book, but I have it on my shelf. We all are resisting doing our best work for fear that it won't be good enough. That's what I'm told. So I get you a little bit past that by showing you where the gold is to keep. That's a thing I learned from Gary. Man, we would highlight the jokes not to mess with, not to get lost. Another thing I learned from him is a way to make sure for filmmakers, in your dailies, you don't always have to give the best joke, the cut that you're going to use to the studio. You might want to save that better joke for a rough cut when they are sick of hearing the same joke over again and they need to laugh. I know you deal with that a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot here for a second. What if you're doing a memoir of somebody and you read the book and you go, "Jesus, this is the most boring human being ever"? What do you do?
Has not happened.
Oh, okay.
First of all, I work with people who are in the business. Their memoirs are interesting. Right now I'm working on a delicious memoir set in in New York City's art performance scene, and a love affair that wasn't supposed to happen. And this fellow wrote around. He tried to make things up. He changed the story. He moved her from being an artist to being a writer. None of it worked because he was faking. Mm. Once we pulled back all the fake stuff and stripped it by 30%, now his pass is to go back into the emotion. He felt all this emotion while he was writing it, but it wasn't on the page. I have yet to read something in a memoir that did not have a piece to offer. So boring, we'll get to it. We'll get down to the core. I do a lot of polishing of specs or adaptations. So if I don't grok the book that I'm adapting from,
right,
I'll have to ask the person, what is it you see in it?
What attracted you? Yeah, what about this material?
Exactly.
What is your process? I mean, do you, let's say you have a manuscript. Do you read it over once just for an overview and then do notes? Or do you do notes as you read it the first time? How do you attack it?
I don't really do notes, which is kind of silly because my whole thing is called scriptnotes.com. But I don't waste a read on an overview because I will only have virgin eyes once.
Okay.
If I have to do a very quick read, and which a manuscript is not, and I must keep my pen off my hand, like, for instance, as a favor, if I'm not getting paid for it, and I have to just help somebody really fast with some pages, I will try not to have my pen in hand. But when I read your manuscript, when I read any manuscript or any script, it's best for me to have my pen in hand because some people say, oh, you can't cut that because at the end, this all matters. I said, well, I'm not reading the end first. Some people do.
Good point.
Yeah. I read it as the viewer will get the material on screen. So you can't tell me something like, oh, here's a cowboy who later will seem not as good as he is. Uh-uh. Here's an innocent cowboy, or whatever the hell I'm talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the thing that writers always hate, but it's a rule we all have to adhere by. It's called kill your babies. It's like there are things that you may love, but they have to come out because the script or the book or the play or whatever will be better.
To that point, I've been called Hollywood's secret weapon by a director friend of mine because I'm able to help him put his babies where they belong, not where he wrote them. Mm. So if you are in love with something, it might be a word, a phrase, a line of dialogue, and if it doesn't work where it is, tell me why you love it and I can find you the spot it will work in.
Okay.
It's just the ability to, I'm old and I'm experienced. I've been around. But I can help you get past your own limitations and your limiting beliefs. When I started, I was one of the earliest script consultants around. I was 20, this is 23 years ago, and there was Linda Seeger, maybe, and McKee, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I do something different than they do, and like not write books and not make a bunch of money off books. But these days, there are blogs and podcasts and seminars, and people are trained by quote-unquote gurus to read with a checklist in mind. And I have to help writers tick all the boxes without it feeling formulaic, with still being true to themselves. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to necessarily kill your baby. It might be the start of another book, for instance. It might be a core piece of the second episode. It might be the thing that is the theme that you don't want to give away in print. It might just be a shot, you know? So look for how your babies can work in other ways. Can it be a shot instead of a line? Mm-hmm. Can it be a theme? Can it be a motif? How to use your writing skills to keep the things you love about writing.
One thing that my partner David Isaacs and I always do is we do one final pass of a script before we turn it in. And anytime there is a big speech for any reason, we go through and thin it out. might be a sentence, might be three words here and five words there and four words there, and it ends up being like a sentence or two worth. But we have never, ever found a long speech that we couldn't edit.
Absolutely.
And it's just, a great lesson to writers, because, you know, you write it and you think every word is like the Rosetta Stone, but you can always cut, you can always make trims.
It's not just about cutting. It's what I work with is evocative economy.
Okay.
Let me use one great word to use your six loose mm-hmm. words. If you as a writer are not speaking while you're standing up, if you are not speaking the dialogue that you're going to ask someone else to speak, you have not finished your script. So one of the things I learned from Gary, we were on the set of Pretty Woman. I won't say who it was who was not comfortable memorizing a long speech, but we had to break it up into smaller pieces with interaction from his co-star. Uh-huh. And it became a wonderful piece of filmic cutting. It became very much a monologue of confession, but we had the interplay that allowed him to learn the sections as smaller pieces. So put yourself in your actor's shoes. If you can't do those 500 sit-ups while you're supposedly proposing to this woman, you'll find yourself trimming.
Yeah. There's an expression in the theater, take out 20 minutes and it'll run 2 years longer.
Absolutely. And you make sure that 20 minutes is in the first act. Mm-hmm. Because the producer will cut the 20 minutes that needs to come out of act two.
If somebody wants to avail themselves of your services, how do they do that?
Scriptnotes.com is up for a scrubbing. So it will point you to my LinkedIn page, but just drop a line, Blair@scriptnotes.com. Tell me Ken sent you, and
okay.
I will definitely give your listeners
free jet skis,
a 1 hour complimentary phoner.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
If they're listening to you, they're already, again, say it with me, ahead of the game, because what your podcast and what your insights in your blog deliver to people, if they actually take your advice, they'll have a stronger script, not even being a better writer. They will be a better writer from putting your tips into action. There's so many things to learn, just tiny things that can change the perception of your material. And we want you to succeed. We want writers to do it.
Thank you. Now, you guys better call, because she doesn't get any calls. I am going to be really pissed at you.
it's all email, but please, I answer quickly.
Great, great. Blair, thank you so much.
Fun to be here in the Kenville.
There you go. I hope you took notes, Blair Richwood, and take advantage of that offer. You know, we don't have too many free offers on this podcast, so take advantage of them when we do. You get that 1 hour complimentary phoner, and all you have to do is email her at Blair, that's Blair, @scriptnotes.com. Again, Blair@scriptnotes.com. You can follow me on Twitter @KenLevine. And if you have any questions or comments, you can always email me at HollywoodLevine@outlook.com. HollywoodLevine@outlook.com. And no, I'm not going to stay on the phone with you for an hour. Our thanks to Adam and Susie Meister Butler, as always, along with Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, and Randy Thomas, and of course, Blair Richwood, name that I stumble on a little bit, but still, she's somebody you ought to know, Blair Richwood. Talk to you again next week. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye. Hollywood.